further ado, but also to add that his younger brother is Avraham Fried, for those who don't really know that. Right, Rabbi Friedman?
And Benny is nothing?
So sorry. But without any further ado, I will let him get into your feminine psyche, and I hope that you enjoy him as thoroughly as I did and as I have in the last 35 years, because it's good to know.
Huh?
The microphone is there if you need it.
Yeah, it works.
It was working before. It should work.
It works. So, 39 years ago was probably the third session of Beis Chana. The first session of Beis Chana, we had absolutely no idea who was coming. We just happened to have a Chabad house, and there was nothing happening. So we sent out a little flyer to a few campuses, and 18 women showed up, unannounced. This is 1971. 18 women come storming into the Chabad house in combat boots. I mean that literally. These were people who had been members of SDS. Anybody? It's not a disease. SDS was the Students for a Democratic Society. These were the people who were burning down campuses. They were the radical activists, and they had tried to stop the Vietnam War, and they weren't successful, and they were very angry. Very angry. And they came storming into the Chabad house, almost offended that the flyer suggested that there was something that they could learn from Judaism about making the world better. Because they had tried to make the world better, and it didn't work. And they came storming into the Chabad. I was like, what do you know? Everybody was frightened. We thought we would have classes like after lunch. In the morning, you know, you go shopping, you do a little sightseeing. It's the summer. They were not interested in shopping or sightseeing. Or starting classes at 12 o'clock and have a few hours of study and then go to sleep. We literally, and by the way, I had no intentions of teaching there either. But they were so intense. Classes began at 9 in the morning, I don't know why, because they went till 8 in the morning. So it really didn't matter when you started class. It went around the clock. They could not learn enough. They could not ask enough questions. They could not make enough demands. And I got such an education on politics and the military-industrial complex and all of the things that they had been studying and fighting for and so on. So here I am, a year out of yeshiva. I've never spoken to a girl in my life. I'm still kind of shy, as you can see. And here I'm surrounded by these demanding women. And I got an education. So we figured this is good. We'll do it again. The next summer, 48 women show up. And I'm ready, because I know all about the military-industrial complex. This is 1972. Nobody was interested in politics. Nobody. They had all just come back from India, from Tibet, from Japan. They were all meditating, they were humming, they were sitting in the lotus position. They were, and all they wanted to know was, what does Judaism teach that Buddhism doesn't teach? And why should they be Jews and not Buddhists? So a whole summer with 48 women, we sat day and night, and I found out all about Buddhism. I don't know if they found out about Judaism, but I found out about Buddhism. I figured, oh, okay, so that's what I need to know. So then we thought, you know, this is so good, let's make a winter program, which is probably the one that you came to. 102 women showed up in the course of the program, and I was ready because I knew all about Buddhism. But nobody was interested in Buddhism. They wanted to know why we eat so many carbohydrates. They were eating macrobiotic and seaweed and carrot juice. And we had 5 kitchens going, and no one touched a tam-tam, which we had bought boxloads of. It was a whole new world. Every single session since then has been different. What was a hot topic the year before, forgotten, uninteresting the next year. One thing has been consistent, and that is relationships. See, anytime the room gets a little boring, classroom is kind of dragging, you know what I mean? And I want to like start things up, all I say is, so, you know, every woman turns out to be like her mother. And the quiet, boring atmosphere is gone. Relationships has always been a meaningful and interesting topic. And it should be. Of course it should be. In most recent years, relationships is also the most painful and the most difficult part of life. People know how to live, people know how to make money, people know how to use technology, people know how to get around, to travel, speak languages. We don't know how to get along. We don't know how to conduct a relationship. Those who have good relationships, they're just plain lucky. Blessed. So let's talk a little bit about relationships. First things first. If we're going to have good relationships, if we're going to have healthy families, healthy marriages, healthy people, we've got to put an end to this thing called love. It's got to go. Love is destroying our relationships. Because every generation has its idol, its Avodah Zarah. The Avodah Zarah of this generation is love. We worship it, we sacrifice to it, we give it credit for things that it doesn't do and can't do. We've elevated love to the status of an idol. And as idols do, it's destroying us because it doesn't work. So the first thing we need to do is put love back into its normal, natural context and position and stop worshiping it. So if you want a proper, correct description of love, love is the appropriate feeling with which to conduct a relationship. It is not a relationship. It is the spice of a relationship. It's the proper mood in which to conduct a relationship. But love is not a relationship. Let's put it in different words. Love is the appropriate emotion towards those people or things in your life that are important. But love does not make anything important. And love itself is not important. It is appropriate for a relationship with someone who is important for whatever reason. So if there's someone important in your life, you ought to love him or her. Why? Because the person is important. If a person is important, you ought to love him. We see this in the davening in Judaism everywhere. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is awesome. Therefore, V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha. Not love God and he will be awesome. He is awesome, he's important, and therefore you should love him. Love your fellow Jew. V'ahavta l'recha kameicha. Why? Because love makes the world go round? No, because Jews make the world go round. Ask any anti-Semite, they'll tell you. And therefore, you should love him. If you have to convince a 10-year-old boy that the brother he hates is more important than the dog he loves, we're in trouble. But think about this. This is really nasty. The belief, the assumption, that my love imparts importance is such an arrogant attitude. It's unbelievable. You're a nothing until I love you. And when I love you, you are the most important thing in the world. And as soon as I stop loving you, get lost. I don't need you. You're nothing again because I stopped loving you. Isn't that horrible? The reverse side of that is, no matter how important you are, no matter how essential you are to my life, if I don't love you, you're nothing. This is horrible. Besides, it's wrong. So, if we put love in its proper context and its proper setting, then it can actually enhance a relationship. When we expect love to be the relationship, you're left with nothing. A feeling can't be a relationship. A feeling means how you feel about a relationship. But the feeling is not the relationship. You have a brother. He's your brother because he's your brother. How do you feel about that? You love him. Good, he's your brother. You hate him. Too bad, he's your brother. I bought my sister a really nice pillow. A souvenir. We were someplace up in the mountains in Colorado and I had to bring something back. So I go into this little shop, and there's this embroidered pillow, you know, a couch pillow. And it was really cute, because on the front it said, I smile because you're my sister. Isn't that beautiful? But that's not why I bought it. On the back of the pillow it says, see, the front says, I smile because you are my sister. On the back it said, and I'm laughing because there's nothing you can do about it. See, that's a sister. What exactly is love? I know the poets have tried for centuries to define love, and they didn't really succeed. I mean, it's not exactly convincing when you say, love means never to have to say I'm sorry. I don't know. That doesn't work. What is love? Tanya says, quoting from the Kabbalah, that a soul contains 7 emotions, and the primary emotion is chesed. Not ahava, chesed. Chesed means generosity. When you are a generous chesed person, you are kind and generous to everyone indiscriminately. Because if you don't bring in gvura, if you don't bring in judgment, if you have only chesed, then it's endless, indiscriminate. Everyone should get everything. Which is nice in some way. But if that chesed, if that generosity gets focused on one person, not to the exclusion of everybody else, but to this person, my kindness becomes personal rather than generic. So chesed means an indiscriminate kindness that doesn't recognize any one person above anyone else. I'm kind to everyone equally. I'm generous to everyone equally. So it's not really about you. I'm just generous. But if my kindness becomes about you, with you my kindness is personal. See, we call that love. A personalized chesed is Ahava. What makes the chesed become personal? There's something about you that appeals to me. Usually because it feels familiar. You're in a room full of strangers, not comfortable. And then you notice someone who either looks or represents something familiar. You're immediately drawn to that. That feeling, that draw, is called love. And what it is the recognition of a certain closeness that demands more closeness. So what is love? A pursuit of closeness. The desire to get closer. When you get closer, you discover that there is a deeper, more subtle separation between you and the other person, and then the love wants to overcome that separation and demands greater closeness. And this can go on for a lifetime between a man and a woman, because they'll never really be close. Because men and women, you know, Mars and Venus. So there will always be more to overcome and greater closeness to pursue. Until you've been married, let's say, 50, 60 years, then the pursuit of love kind of settles down, because you've gotten pretty close by then, I think. And it's replaced, the pursuit of love is replaced with pleasure. So for 50 years, you are the love of my life. And after 50 years, you become the pleasure of my life. And so elderly couples just merge into each other because they are the pleasure of their lives. This is called in Shir HaShirim, in the Song of Songs, it's called Ahava B'Tanugin, a love that turns into pleasure. What is the difference between love and pleasure? Love is a pursuit. As soon as you say love, you're implying a discomfort, an uncontentment. Because if you were content, you wouldn't be pursuing closeness. So love always suggests a dissatisfaction, not yet satisfied. And that's why absence makes the heart grow fonder. Absence actually activates love. But pleasure doesn't work that way. Pleasure is not a pursuit. If you're pursuing pleasure, you got some problems. You don't pursue pleasure. That's an addiction. You don't pursue pleasure. pleasure is experienced only when you have the object of your pleasure. Absence does not make pleasure greater. So when there's no chocolate around, you don't enjoy it more. You suffer. Because it's not here. So, well, I'm so looking forward to chocolate, it's a pleasure. No, it's a pain. So if the object of your pleasure is absent, it doesn't increase the pleasure. It hurts. So for 50 years, you pursue closeness because you still need more. And that's great because when you need more, it makes the love more intense because absence makes the heart grow fonder. But when you finally have the object of your love, then it becomes pleasure because pleasure is experienced when you get there. When you have it. So that's called Ahava B'Tanugim. Now, let's talk a little bit about marriage. Anybody interested? Yeah? I don't know if you've noticed this, but men and women are really not good for each other. Oh, you've noticed. I see, you're laughing in agreement. You've noticed. Men and women are terrible for each other. See, I never read the book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. Because once you read the title, what's the point? If we're from different planets, I get the message. We'll never get along. Okay, fine. What do I need 300 pages worth of misery? I get it. Men and women are not good for each other. And they're really not. For all these years, maybe since 1900, we've been trying to get along. Men and women. We've really tried. It's not working. It's terrible. You have a man in your life, you are interrupted. A man has a woman in his life, he's messed up. And what they try to do is get men and women to be in each other's lives younger, earlier, which messes you up much more. Because you never get to be a girl, because you're already a half a boy. And the guy never gets to be a man. You know what I'm talking about. So I never understood when a man and a woman are trying to have a relationship and it's not going, it's not working, they go for therapy. For therapy. They come to a therapist and say, what's wrong with us? We're not getting along. And the therapist says, oh, well, you got to try to learn how to communicate. And what are you talking about? A man and a woman don't get along. You don't need therapy. You're normal. You see a man and a woman who do get along, one of them, or maybe both, needs serious therapy. Because this is not right. Either he's not really... Something's wrong. So God, in his great wisdom, invented marriage. What does marriage do? Marriage transforms a man into a husband. And it transforms a woman into a wife. Now, men and women are better off without each other. Husbands and wives are no good without each other. You can't be a husband without a wife. Not even a bad husband. The only way to be a bad husband is with a wife. So husbands and wives are inseparable. Men and women are better off without each other. So it would be a tragedy if a man and a woman get married, but they refuse to change. He doesn't want to be a husband, he remains a man. And she doesn't want to be a wife, she remains a woman. And now you have a man and a woman who can't get along living in the same house. Well, what do you expect? There are going to be problems. Why don't men want to become husbands? It's not glamorous. Why don't women want to become wives? What, and have everybody make fun of you and all the jokes about wives? No, it's not attractive. It's not appealing. See, when married women get together and go out for a night, what is it called?
A girl's night
out. A girl's night out? They're afraid to admit that they're women? No, they're afraid to admit they're wives. So they run away from that as far as they can get. Because women are glamorous. Wives are desperate. Why would you want to be a housewife? In other words, the media has painted the wife in such negative colors. Why would anybody want to be that? And husbands are described as such losers, such wimps, such babies. Why would you want to be a husband? So, a big part of the problem in marriages today is that there are no husbands and there are no wives. That doesn't work. It doesn't work. So if you're going to get married, if you believe in marriage, you have to welcome the opportunity to become a wife, not remain a woman. Let me give you a really powerful, painful example. A wife is very unhappy, and she demands that they go for counseling. And finally, he agrees. They go for therapy. They go for counseling. She sits down with the counselor and she says, I'm miserable. I can't sleep at night because every time we go out, he is flirting with the women. He's the life of the party. And that leaves me feeling totally insecure. My marriage, I don't know, it's not a marriage. I can't live like this. The counselor very patiently and very gently explains to this woman that men have this need to show off when they're in the presence of women. It's called the peacock syndrome. You got to show off. It's harmless. It doesn't mean he doesn't love you. It doesn't mean he doesn't want to be married to you. It doesn't mean that he's running around with other women. It's just a man thing. There's no reason to feel threatened by it. So she goes home feeling a little silly. She made a big deal out of nothing. Right? She gets home and it suddenly hits her. My problem is that my husband flirts with women. I know men do that. But a husband? So what did she tell me? What did the counselor tell me? It's a man thing. Well, there's my problem. I'm married to a man. I don't have a husband. Because certainly, as much as men might need to show off in front of women, a husband doesn't. Why would a husband need to show up? So that means that he has never become a husband. No wonder I don't feel married. No wonder I feel alone. I don't have a husband. So some women say, you know, it's not like I have a husband and three children. It's like I have four children. My husband never grew up. He never became a man. It's not true. He is a man. He's not a husband. So he might as well be your fourth child. And of course, the same is true with a woman who refuses to become a wife. Husband doesn't feel married. Now, as long as we're talking about marriage, there's another very serious problem. I love you, you love me, let's get married. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. Because we love each other, we should therefore get married. How did you come to that conclusion? What has loving each other have to do with marriage? Did you ever see married people who love each other? I didn't mean that. Why, if you love each other, should you get married? What's the connection? It's like, well, if we love each other, shouldn't we live in Cleveland? If we love each other, shouldn't we be married? Why? Why? When did love and marriage become synonymous? It's almost like you can't love someone without marrying them? I don't think that's true. You marry someone, that's the only person you're ever going to love. You'll never love anybody else. That's pretty sad. And what if I want to love you and not marry you? Too bad? Marriage is the punishment for being in love? That's the price you pay? Hey, you want to love? You got to be married. Why are we being punished? Along the same line, you're going to get married to some guy. The guy, the one and only, Mr. Right. How do you know? How will you know? How will you identify or recognize Mr. Right? This woman says, took me many years, but I finally met Mr. Right. And I found out that his first name is Always. So you can meet Mr. Right and then be in big trouble. How do you know who the right guy is? So let's get a little religious about this. The reason you get married is not because you're in love. That is such a silly notion. The reason you get married is because marriage is so right and so important and so good. From the time you're 8 years old, you want to get married. Because that's normal. The only problem is that being married involves another person. That's where it gets a little sticky. You want to be married because of marriage. Because being married, being a wife, being a mother, having a home, raising children, that's life. So why do you want to be married? Why do you want to breathe? The only difference is you can breathe by yourself. Except when you're pregnant and in labor. Then you need a breathing coach. But otherwise you can probably breathe by yourself. Marriage involves another person. So, you want to get married because marriage is so right. You're in love with marriage. That's why you get married. Not because of him. You're getting married because you love marriage. If you don't love marriage, don't do it, no matter how much you love him. If you're in love with marriage, because marriage is fantastic, because marriage is the right way, it's the divine way to be, it's God's plan, now the question is, just a mere technicality, who are you going to marry? Naturally, it's a lot more enjoyable to marry someone you get along with. Much more enjoyable you marry someone who is appealing, who's lovable. Makes it a lot easier. So who is this lovable guy and where is he hiding? Judaism says he has been appointed, chosen, and set aside, reserved for you from the moment he was, before he was conceived and before you were born. Which means to say, you already have a husband. You just haven't met him yet. And therefore, worrying, scheming, planning, imagining what kind of a man you want to marry, you're wasting your time and your energy and you're making yourself crazy because it's already been chosen, it's already done, he already has a name, he already has an address, that's it, it's him. So, well, I don't want to marry a very tall guy. Too bad. Your husband is tall. Sorry. What are you picking? It's not like a Mr. Potato Head, you know, you can put together. I want a guy with a little like this and put like, what do you end up with? You have a husband. And if he's tall, he's tall. What are you going to do about it? And if he's short, too bad. He's your husband. So stop worrying. Stop scheming. I'm going to marry a guy who looks like this. No, you're not. You're going to marry your husband, and he looks nothing like this. Or maybe he does. I don't know. Maybe he does. In fact, maybe the guy you're looking at is your husband. Check it out. So, you already have a husband, because that's how husbands are created. God appoints this man for this woman. What makes this man right for this woman? They were once one soul and they got divided. Just like the body, the first human being, Adam, was created male and female. And then God divided them. Which is why they're constantly trying to find each other again. The attraction of male to female and female to male is not sexual. We now know in our modern enlightened times that for sexual purposes you don't need a man and a woman. So if there's an attraction between a man and a woman, it's got to be something else. What is attractive about a man to a woman and a woman to a man? The attraction is, weren't we once one? You look so familiar. We were once one. A human being is supposed to be male and female. That uncomfortable feeling of being only female or only male is unnatural. So our original nature draws us to each other. A man needs a female half, and the female needs a male half, and when they meet, they literally become one body. That's the power of marriage. Not two people loving each other. Two people becoming each other. And that can only happen, male and female, because the original human being was male and female, not male and male. So what is the powerful and universal attraction between men and women? The need to be whole. The need to become one. You don't become one through love. You become one through marriage. Why don't you become one through love? Well, because love is actually the thing that keeps you separate. Because if I love you really, intensely, deeply, profoundly, then I am so busy. I have no time for you. My love keeps me so busy, I barely have time for you. So if I say, I love you so much, and you say, and I love you even more, you see, we can't get along. We can't agree on anything. Mm-hmm. I say, I love you, and you change the subject. And say, enough about you. I love you. No, I love you. No. I love you. These people are never going to become one. If you're looking for love, write this down. If you're looking for love, don't get married. If you're looking for love, don't get married. It's not nice. You're looking... If you're looking for love, then you're busy. You're preoccupied. Don't involve another person in your life. You have no room for that other person. You're busy loving. To have another person in your life, you have to be available to that person. If you want love, then you don't want the person. You don't want him. You want love. Well, then why are you bothering him? Leave him alone. You want love, go back to your mother. Love can be the most selfish emotion, the most selfish experience in our lives. Love means, I want to get closer to you, not I want love. See, there is no thing called love. Love means, I need you, not I need love. That makes sense? No? Very common. Man and a woman get married. Why? Because they're in love. Why else? 3 months later, they're getting divorced. Why? Because they fell out of love. In other words, marriage is a non-entity. There was love, now there's no love. That's it. So what was the marriage? Marriage means I need you in my life. If love becomes your objective, if what you want is love, then you don't really want him. And that's why if you fall out of love, him is gone. Let me give an example. Imagine. Thank you. Imagine a man is running down the street in a great hurry, and you stop him and you say, "Where are you running? What's the matter?" And he says, "My wife is very ill. I'm running to get a doctor." and you say, that's beautiful. Oh, that's so romantic. You love your wife so much. I'm all verklempt. And the guy says, did I say anything about love? It just so happens that we don't get along so good. In fact, we haven't talked in a month. Would you say to this man, well, in that case, what's the rush? Slow down. Take it easy. Let's have a cup of coffee. We'll talk. You'll get the doctor later. What would he say? He'd say, you're crazy. My wife needs a doctor. And you would say, but you don't love her. And he would say, what's love got to do with it? She needs a doctor. Which means, the fact that she is his wife gives her a certain place in his life that is significant, important, with or without love. It's her. She needs. What has love got to do with her needs? I'm in love, I'm not in love. It's her. It's about her. To put it in rather graphic terms, what is intimacy between a husband and a wife? Intimacy means the ability that we have to get beyond, move ourselves beyond everything in life until there is nothing left but each other. Not even the love for each other, because that's a thing. If you get past all things and you are left just the two of you, like Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, that's called intimacy. Anytime something comes between a husband and wife that actually they share in common, that marriage is ruined. If there is a common interest, but it's something other than each other, that compromises the marriage. Marriage means it's just us. Us. You mean we love each other? No, it's just us. Just me and you. I'm not a thing, you're not a thing, so there is nothing besides us. We now know, even in the secular world, that objectifying a person is pornography. When you look at somebody as a thing, you're abusing them. That's abuse. A human being is not a thing. So intimacy means the ability that two people have to get so focused on each other that there is nothing, nothing else in their world at that moment, including love. If love becomes your thing, then you're not capable of merging with another person, because you can't get past this thing called love. So if a husband says to his wife, do you love me? Like Tevye and Golda. Do you love me? You know what Golda said? Do I what? What she was saying is, I have you. Why do I need love? Or, you have me, why do you need love? Am I not more important than love? 25 years? What do you need love? You have me, love is the pursuit of me. I'm not running away, you have me. No, you want to pursue me. Sorry, I've done your laundry too many times. You can't pursue me anymore. I'm here, it's me. It's us. And that's why, if you asked your great-grandmother, you know, when people were a little modest, if you ask your great-grandmother, so what happens when a husband and wife go in the bedroom? Your great-grandmother said, nothing. And you said, oh, come on, tell me. And she said, nothing. You said, why won't you tell me? And she said, there's nothing. So you went to your friends and you found out. You found out the wrong thing. Your grandmother was right. In the bedroom between a husband and wife, there is nothing. That's called intimacy. Intimacy means two people with nothing. Nothing between them. Nothing else besides them. Just them. So when husband and wife go into the bedroom and close the door, there is nothing. Because he's not a thing, she's not a thing. Who are you calling a thing? So when a husband and wife have been intimate, you can't ask, how was it? There is no it. Because if there is an it, and they weren't intimate. So love can become the cause of a breakdown in a marriage. If you want love, get it from your mother. You want marriage, get married. And when you're married, might as well love him, you're stuck with him. That's how love works. You find yourself stuck with a guy, might as well love him. Make your life a lot easier. So if you find yourself worrying or daydreaming about who you're going to marry, you're wasting your time. The decision has been made. Now, according to Kabbalah, why don't you put on tefillin? The answer is, one soul doesn't have to put on tefillin twice. Your husband is putting on tefillin, so you don't have to. Because one soul doesn't have to put on tefillin twice. Which means whoever your husband is and wherever he is, if he's not putting on tefillin, he's got to answer to you. Because he just cheated you out of tefillin. So when you meet your husband, bring that up. What should you be worried about? What should you be thinking about? Not who you're going to marry. How? How are you going to be married? What kind of wife, what kind of life are you going to produce? That's a very good question. And that's completely up to you, so it's a good thing to be thinking about. But who you're going to marry, well, people think, I can marry anybody I want. No? Free choice. I can marry anybody I want. So there are 6 billion people in the world, 3 billion men. You can marry any one of those 3 billion men. Hypothetically. It takes way too long to meet 3 billion men. By then you'll be too old to get married altogether. So no, you can't marry any one of 3 billion men. You can only marry one of those men who you happen to meet in the course of a year or two from now. That's not 3 billion. Now we're down to maybe 30. That was a quick jump. We're down to about 30 men. Now, half of those men are married. So now we're down to 15. Of these 15 men, 12 of them have no interest in marrying you. I mean, come on, you don't really think 12 men are going to run after you wanting to marry you, right? So what are you down to? 3? One of them you don't really like that much. So now we're down to 2. Wow, you have such freedom of choice. It's him or him. Which one? And between him and him, there's really no contest. So it's down to the one you like better of the 2. How did that happen? It happened because that's how God makes you marry your husband. He arranges it. He works it all out. He schemes all night long. That's what the Gemara says. He's up all night making sure that you meet your husband. So what are you worried about? If you are worried about what kind of a life you're going to create with your husband, that's good. That's productive. That's useful. You can make a difference in the quality of your marriage to your husband who has already been chosen. So what does it mean, your soulmate, your bashert? It doesn't mean that you run around checking guys out. You my bashert? You my bashert? You don't look like my bashert. Soulmate doesn't help you get married. Because you don't know your soulmate until you're married to him. So what value is there in knowing that you have a soulmate? The value is, once you marry, you know that this is your soulmate, you will try your best to make it work. But if you think the guy you're married to is just your choice, and you just changed your mind, what's the big deal? Oops, we're divorced. But if it's your soulmate, and there's a problem, and you made a mistake, you thought he was tall and he's not, but he's your soulmate, so you'll work on it. So you'll be devoted. But it doesn't help you find him. So how do you know who's Mr. Right? You meet a guy, you talk to him, you get to know him a little bit, and you want him to be the one. That's all you need to know. You don't need a guarantee, you don't need proof that he is the one. You need to know that you want him to be the one. You would be thrilled if he was the one. Then you marry him. If you end up married to him, then he is the one. If he's not the one, you will not marry him. Something will happen, something will come up, and you will not marry him. Because he's not the one. So, soulmate means 2 things. It means you will not marry anyone else who is not your soulmate. And it means you will marry your soulmate no matter how difficult you may be. You may resist, you may try to avoid it, you're going to marry your soulmate. There will be no mistake ever, ever, ever. No one in history ever married the wrong person. just like no one in history ever had someone else's child. You can't give birth to someone else's child. And you can't be married to someone else's husband. It can't happen. Because if you could be married to somebody else's husband, then the child you're having is wrong child. You can't have the wrong child, so you can't have the wrong husband. So here's the romantic notion in Torah. A woman feels like a woman, which means she feels complete. She feels satisfied and content when she is able to surrender herself completely, unconditionally, unhesitatingly to her husband. If she can't do that, then she does not feel like a woman, she does not feel natural, she does not feel completed, and she is frustrated. Not a little frustrated, totally frustrated. If you have to reserve some part of yourself from your husband, you're frustrated. It's so frustrating. If you can't really surrender to him in absolute confidence, then you're not alive. It's totally frustrating. That's why marriage is necessary, because only marriage could give you the security that would allow you to completely surrender yourself to your husband. If you don't have that security, then you can't afford to be so vulnerable. And a woman who can't be vulnerable is frustrated. Because your greatest strength is your vulnerability. So that's why we get this picture. A husband is supposed to build a house, marry a woman, and bring her to his house. In other words, create a secure place for your wife, then bring your wife to that secure place. But we needn't take it so literally. It doesn't have to be a building that gives security. The husband has to provide a totally secure reality to which the wife can completely surrender. What is that security? Himself. If she feels that she has him completely, then she can surrender to him completely. If there's any room for doubt, maybe he's not really there for her, maybe he's not really loyal to her, maybe he's not really committed, ruins everything. And that's why a man and a woman having a relationship, living together without marriage, it's destructive. Because the woman can't surrender. So it's kind of a reserved intimacy, a partial intimacy, an incomplete intimacy. And that is frustrating. One final thing. When a couple are successfully intimate, which means they've managed to get beyond all things and they experience only themselves, each other, you come away cleansed, feeling more innocent than before. Because the part of you that can transcend all things, where nothing is important except each other, that is the most innocent part of you. When you get past all stuff, then what's left? What's left is the real you that is completely innocent. So after being intimate, a husband and wife feel more innocent than before. That's the kedusha. That's the holiness of marriage. So the notion, you know, the picture, the romantic image, a man and a woman, and all they need is love. And love will keep them together. And love will see them through all their problems. And love will make it all wonderful. It's almost true. Almost. Their relationship with each other will see them through everything. It will make their life worth living. You didn't see that, did you?
No.
Okay. But it's not love. It's each other. That closeness, that oneness, will keep them together forever. And that's why you should love it. Make sense? So if you have that kind of a relationship, what's not to love? So that's what Golda was saying. It's not, love is not the thing. The thing is to get into each other so thoroughly that there is nothing between us. And if you have that, what's not to love? That's very lovable. So in the old-fashioned notion, get married and you will learn to love each other. Not you'll learn to love each other. Get married and you will have every reason to love each other. Because that kind of innocence, how can you not love it? Make sense? That is the most courageous little mouse I've ever seen. He's not afraid of a room full of women. Any questions or comments? Yes.
How does this philosophy come into play with multiple marriages?
You're saying you'll only marry your soulmate. So, was your first husband or wife your soulmate?
I'm just a little surprised because we're having so much. We have such a hard time getting to the first one, and you're worried about the multiples.
I'm just wondering.
Yes.
How you reconcile the two ideas?
Right. There's no contradiction, really. Every marriage is made in heaven. Where there are a number of marriages, it means that this was destined to be your first husband. This is destined to be your second husband. Both are destined. Both are husbands, not men. And just like you don't have to worry about the first guy you're going
to
marry, because it's done.
Married
to the person you're supposed to be married to, then you have no interest in marrying another guy. Why do marriages fall apart? Maybe because a match made in heaven could be a real challenge for people living on earth. So yes, God made this match because from a heavenly perspective, these two souls will complete each other. But these two souls are now on earth. It could be too much. So it's the right match, but the right match could be too much of a challenge. So God invents divorce. It's his invention. He invented marriage. He invented divorce. So he gets you married to the person you're supposed to be married to, and he lets you get divorced if it's too painful. So knowing that you're married to the right person, even though it might be a difficult, you will try. If it fails, the second marriage will be just as meaningful, just as right, and therefore you should try just as hard on the second one to make it work, because it's the right thing. So again, the right thing doesn't mean the easy thing. We have this impression, if you meet the one you're supposed to marry, it's going to be smooth sailing all the way through. No. Again, just like with children. You don't have the wrong children. And yet, raising your own children who are absolutely right for you can be very difficult, painful. But you know they're yours, so you keep trying. If there was even a suspicion that maybe they're not yours, you would have quit a long time ago. So bashert doesn't mean easy. It means worth every effort. That's what it means. Yeah?
What's the difference between the love you describe, or not the love, but this being drawn towards someone, comfortability, whatever, before actually knowing the person, versus the love that's depicted in the media? In other words, you describe love as something as like, you have loving someone means they're important to you, you give to them. But being drawn to a random stranger is, they're obviously not important to you yet, but you still have this type of emotion or feeling. What would that be described as?
The attraction you have to a guy who you might end up marrying or do end up marrying, obviously, it's a combination of all sorts of stuff. Psychological stuff, emotional stuff. The best and healthiest part of it is that attraction that you have or desire to become one, to become complete. Not to get something. Most desires, most attractions have an ambition. You want to get something. So you go out with a guy and you're thinking, what will I get from him? What has he got to offer? That's not the real attraction. Because whatever he has to offer, you can probably get it from somebody else as well. He's not that unique. So what is the truest attraction? The attraction that doesn't want anything. You want wholeness, not something. What tells you that you could achieve this with this particular man? There's this thing called good chemistry. What is good chemistry? It doesn't mean a sexual excitement. Good chemistry means when you're sitting with this guy, you feel comfortable with you. Not with him. With you. Which means he allows you to be you. He makes you comfortable. Comfortable with what? Comfortable with yourself as a woman. Because when a man and a woman meet, there's usually some kind of friction. You need to make an impression. You start to worry. You know, am I woman enough? Is he man enough? Are we? If that happens, it's bad chemistry. When you're sitting with a guy and you're feeling comfortable with yourself as a woman, he's doing that. He is making you comfortable. Somehow. And that's good chemistry. That means if you marry this guy, it could be very good. When you end up married to him, he's the right guy. He's the one. So the chemistry is not love, a romantic love, and it's not even the love of someone who's important because he's not yet important to you. When you're married to him, then the love kicks in. Real love, not just... Yeah.
That feeling of being comfortable, are you saying that that only comes when you're with the guy that you're supposed to marry? Because that can happen with a lot of people if you're just comfortable.
No. It's not that it can only happen with the guy you're going to marry. Anyone that it happens with, you would be willing to marry. Is he the right one? You'll marry him. He's not the right one, you won't get married. But what do you need to know in deciding that you want to marry him? What you need to know is that you've got good chemistry. Because if you don't have good chemistry, then you better pray he's not the one. Yeah.
This concept, again, going back to just the one person, I mean, even in Torah, isn't there a concept that there's really seven people? Or is it seven? Yeah? That you could end up with? So, I mean, it's just very hard to believe that there's just one person in the world, you know? And having that thought process that there could be six other people, it makes it a little bit more complicated than just...
Whatever is uncomfortable about the thought that there's only one doesn't get much better if there are only seven. How did that happen? Who picked seven? I don't know either. And I don't think that's correct. It's some kind of a theoretical whatever. Of the seven, there's one you're going to marry. Otherwise, the whole notion of destined means nothing. It's like saying, I want to tell you something. You are destined to marry one of these guys. What does that tell me? Destined means this is the one and nothing is going to change it. If you can change it, if you can switch this guy for the other guy, then it's not destined. It's like the comedian says, why do all men at a wedding wear the same tuxedo? The bride dresses differently from all the other women. The groom is wearing the same tuxedo all the guys are wearing. They all look alike. He says, I figured it out. The vows, the minister, the priest or whatever says, do you take this man to be your lawfully wedded husband? He doesn't say a name. He just says, this man. So if she says no, well, there's another guy already dressed. You bring him up and say, will you take this man? No? Okay, next. See, that's why. If that is an option, then there is no Basheret. If you can marry some other guy as well, then nobody is Basheret. So, oh no, but it's limited to seven. Oh, thank you very much. So, let's keep things simple. Basheret means, like it says in the Gemara, the angel announces that this child about to be born will marry that child. No ifs, no options, no seven dwarfs. Yeah.
Idealistic instead of realistic. Idealistic is
Well, yeah, that is a bad habit that he has. He is very idealistic. He actually thinks this world is worth it. How idealistic can you get? Obviously, even when a marriage fails on earth, it accomplished something for the duration that it existed. It accomplished something on earth. So the world is now better off because you were married. You just couldn't get more out of it because it got to be too much, too painful. Like, for example, there's a child. You're married for a year and you get divorced, but there's a child. That was not in vain. That marriage accomplished something awesome. But it couldn't accomplish any more because it got to be too painful. So when God is idealistic, it's also realistic to some degree. So it's never in vain, even when there's no child. Yeah.
You had said earlier in your lecture that love is the pursuit that two people have to become closer and closer together. And then later you had said that you don't become one through love. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how those two ideas don't work. I mean, if you're pursuing to become closer and closer together, wouldn't that make you one? Why is it not love that would make you one?
Okay. The pursuit of closeness is not the pursuit of oneness. Closeness is a something that I can appreciate and enjoy for me.
That's why it's selfish.
That's why it's selfish. So if I want to get closer to you, and you want to get closer to me, we're both busy with our own agenda. I want closeness, but with you. You want closeness, but with me. We're working in opposite directions. So even if we achieve the closeness, we've each gotten what each of us wants. Like the pleasure of intimacy. I want the pleasure, you want the pleasure, we both get the pleasure, and we're two very separate people. So what does oneness mean? Oneness means I'm not trying to get anything. I want nothing, just be there. You're a very painful example, but I think it helps. Imagine people who have a parent who is very ill and goes into a coma for years. Somebody's mother is in a coma for years, completely vegetative. No communication, no recognition, nothing. At the end of a few years, they get a phone call saying, your mother passed away. And they fall apart. They fall apart. They get hysterical. The cold-blooded question is, what's the big deal? What's the big deal? She was kind of useless anyway. Why is that wrong? Why is that totally inhumane? She was useless. What have you lost? She couldn't talk anyway. Didn't know you anyway. Didn't communicate. What have you lost? The answer is, I've lost her. Her. Not something about her, just her. She was here and now she's not. That's called oneness. But if you say, oh, who's going to love me now? Then you're not mourning her death. You're mourning the loss of love. And sooner or later, you'll find somebody else to love you, and then it'll be okay. So what does it mean, a husband and wife become one? It means it's about you now, not something about you, just you, which means you have to be in my life. And what will I get out of it? I don't need anything. I need you to be in my life. Now, is that romantic? Is that awesome? Is that scary? Is it love? No. Because love is a thing. I get it from my mother, I get it from my friends, I get it from my love. It's a thing. Let me put it this way, and that will settle the whole thing. Do you ever hear a mother say to her children, you know, if you don't love me, I can always get love from the neighbor's children. You're not the only children in the world. A mother would never say that for the very simple reason she doesn't want love from her children. If she wanted love from her children and she wasn't getting it, then she might very well say, okay, I'm not getting it from you, I'll get it from somebody else. But she doesn't want love from her children. She wants her children's love. Oh, that's very different. If you want your children's love, how can you get it from other children? So when you say, my children's love, what are you talking about? Something called love? No, you're talking about your children. But if you say, love from my children, you're talking about this thing called love, which you could get from somebody else. The same is true with a husband. You ready for this? You don't want love from your husband. You want your husband's love. Huge difference. You don't want love, you want husband love. And that you can get from only one guy. And we already know who he is. You don't, but somehow it's already known who that guy is. And only his love is meaningful to you. That's what I'm saying. You don't want love from a husband. You can get that from your mother. You want your husband's love. That's a completely different thing. You don't want love from your children. You want your children's love. Oh, that's a mother. Not a lonely soul. If you want love, you're a lonely soul. If you want your children's love, you're a mother. You want love from a man, you're not a wife. You want your husband's love, now you're a wife. God doesn't want love. He wants our love, the Jewish people. He wants Jews to love him, not because he wants love, but because he wants us. So when we don't love him, which happens quite often, when we don't love him, he still wants us. Because it's about us, not about love. God is not love. That's Christian. God is our God. So he wants us to love him. If we don't, he still wants us. Make sense? So, ladies and gentlemen, you should all have good news. You should all understand and appreciate the holiness of marriage. It is something much greater and bigger than a love affair. And when we find our husbands and our wives, we should treat it with awe and respect, because it's a divine plan. And when you're married, you can produce the most incredible creature in the world, and that is a Jewish baby. Does it get any better than that? I don't think so. So we should all have good news. Succeed in your studies. Have good news to share with each other. And make the world a little better, because it ain't going to happen by itself. The world is getting worse by the minute. So we got to do something about it. Bring goodness into the world. Bring holiness into the world. Only Jews can do it. And that's not arrogant. I say that in all humility. Only Jews can bring real godliness to the world. And that's what we're here for. And that's what the rest of the world is depending on. They don't bother being good because they know we're going to do it. Let's talk to a non-Jew. That's what they say. You're the chosen people. You do it. You didn't hear that? There are 22 Arab countries in the Middle East. Who should make peace? See? They know. They know. Who's going to make peace in the world? The Jews. Just don't tell us how. Don't give us your suggestions. We can come up with better plans than that. But yes, we are going to fix the world because we are the chosen people. We got to get comfortable with that, and we got to act on it and live up to that reputation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Rabbi Friedman for coming out here. And again, to our sponsors for TAC, Chabad Club, Mathina, Matis and Novi Cecil, and our anonymous sponsor. And also, guys, just to let you know about a few events that are coming up. Chabad Club is running an excursion that we're selling in menorahs for $1.